I'm Marty Moscoen. Welcome to Radio Times. 3 years ago, we had no idea that within a few months, a deadly pneumonia-like virus, SARS-CoV-2, would create a pandemic, overwhelming healthcare systems, shutting down the global economy, infecting more than half a billion and killing millions of people worldwide, leaving misery and unanswered questions in its wake. The virus continues to mutate, and according to the New York Times tracker, there were almost 39,000 new COVID-19 cases on Monday, and yesterday, 379 people died from the disease. Vaccines and treatments have been extraordinarily helpful, though, in containing the spread and the threat of this virus. So what have we learned about this virus, its origins, its behavior, its lethality, its future? Science writer David Quammen essentially foretold this pandemic in his book Spillover, Animal Infections and the Next Human Pandemic, written almost 10 years ago. His new book Breathless, The Scientific Race to Defeat a Deadly Virus, is about the scientists who first identified and tracked the evolution of SARS-CoV-2, which made vaccines possible. And David Quammen, as I mentioned, he's an award-winning science journalist and joins us from Montana, where he lives. And David, nice to have you back with us on Radio Times.
Thank you, Marty. Good to be back with you.
Good to have you back with us. And let me just make sure our listeners can join our conversation because there's a lot of important information that we will be talking about. You can email us at radiotimes@whyy.org. You can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. And you can always call us. That phone number is 1-888-477-9499. And David, I remember interviewing you at the beginning of the pandemic. And here we are about 2.5 years later, President Biden says the pandemic is over. As a science writer, do you agree?
Well, it depends on how you define pandemic. I see his point. We are getting back toward normal, opening schools, our economy is functioning again. But the virus is not over. COVID-19 is not over. It may be the endemic phase now versus the pandemic phase, but this virus is still very much with us, still dangerous, still evolving. As you said, it killed 379 people in the U.S. just yesterday. We still have to take it very seriously.
When you use the word endemic, and words are important in this conversation, how should we behave then?
Well, I'm not a public health official or a medical person. I listen to the same experts that you do. They are telling us to go about our lives, to be aware that the virus is still here. I saw Tony Fauci just a day or two ago saying that he wears a mask when he goes to places where the virus is particularly active. He wears it while he's indoors, does not wear it outside. Keep your masks in your pocket and be ready to use them, and get yourself vaccinated and get yourself boosted. Those are the first things on the list in terms of what we should do.
You mentioned boosted, and there is a third booster that's really tailored to, at least as the virus as it exists today, and I read that only 4% of people have gotten the booster.
That's right, and that really has to change. I think we're at somewhere in the high 60s for people having gotten vaccinated. In terms of getting first boosters, it's, I think, around half of that, and only about 4% having gotten the latest one. And I've gotten the latest one.
I got it
in early September, and I still came down with a case of COVID. I've tested positive for the last 2.5 weeks, although I've been very lucky to be vaccinated and to have access to Paxlovid, so my case hasn't been very bad, but it is a very enterprising virus.
That's fascinating, and I hope you're feeling okay. I mean, do you know how you...
I'm feeling fine.
You're feeling fine, and thanks, hopefully, to the vaccines and the boosters, but do you know, since you track these things, do you know where you got COVID?
I don't know exactly, but I made a trip to Washington, D.C. from Bozeman for a book event, and I wore a mask on the plane all the way going, all the way coming back. We wore masks at the event. It was the Atlantic Magazine's festival. We all were masked as we did our event, but somewhere, perhaps in a restaurant or in the hotel, I seemed to have picked it up, and as I flew back to Montana, I started to feel a raw throat. Tested negative that afternoon, tested positive the next morning, and I've been isolating ever since.
Wow.
That's 2.5 weeks ago.
And you're still testing positive?
I tested very faintly positive yesterday. I'm hoping that today, knock wood, I might test negative.
Well, me too. Well, let's talk about this virus. And let's even talk about viruses in general that you call the dark angels of evolution. What do you mean by that?
Well, if you look at the role of viruses in evolution, what you see pretty quickly is that they are not all bad. They are these genetic parasites. They move DNA and RNA from one creature to another, sometimes dropping their own genomes into the cells of other creatures, into the nucleus, so they become part of the genome. And for instance, and I wrote a book about this about 5 years ago, viruses constitute 8% of the human genome, viral DNA that has been inserted into the mammal lineage over the last 100 years constitute 8% of the human genome. And some of those genes that originated in viruses are responsible for important functions, important changes in evolution, evolutionary history of mammals, and important functions even in humans. There is a gene in the human genome, syncytin number 2, that's important, absolutely essential in successful human pregnancy. That gene is viral DNA that was dropped in our genome some millions of years ago.
So can we assume that these current viruses, and it's more than SARS-CoV-2, are changing our genome?
No. There are particular kinds of viruses that change our genomes, retroviruses. Retro as in backwards. They go backwards because they insert their genomes into the genomes of the cells they infect. If they insert their genome into immune cells, the way HIV-1 does, they can destroy those immune cells and cause AIDS. Other kinds of retroviruses, in certain cases, insert their genomes into reproductive cells, into sperm cells and egg cells and the stem cells that make those. And when they do that, then they can be inherited. They can be made permanent in the human lineage, the human genome. But not coronaviruses.
Well, let's talk about, do we know then the origin of the SARS-CoV-2?
We don't know the exact origin. The scientific evidence very, very strongly supports the idea that this is an animal virus that spilled over into humans, probably originally a virus in horseshoe bats in southern China, possibly having swapped some sections with other coronaviruses while infecting a single animal. The coronaviruses can swap sections. It's called recombination. So there are bits of it that may have come into this virus from other coronaviruses, and then spilled over into humans, probably in that market that we've heard about, the Huanan Seafood Wholesale Market in the city of Wuhan. But we don't yet have the progenitor virus, the virus from a non-human animal that is 99.6% similar to this virus. So the search has to continue. The screening of wildlife and domestic livestock needs to continue. And the search generally needs to continue. People, of course, say, well, what about a lab leak? What about an engineered virus? We need to continue to investigate that. There is a non-zero but very small, I think, possibility of that. There is no active positive evidence showing that here is a virus that was in the lab and spilled out. But still, we need to keep our minds open and keep searching for final evidence of the origins of this virus.
You mentioned the seafood market in Wuhan, and this is where these are markets that are a mix of what, wild animals along with, I guess, animals that we would recognize at our supermarket?
That's right, and these are known as wet markets, but a wet market is a market that also provides fresh vegetables to people. It provides fresh poultry to people. It provides fresh seafood. In some cases, as in the case of this Huanan market, it was also providing live wild animals on sale for food and also some for pets. And that represents a very dangerous sort of situation because all animals, all creatures, all cellular kinds of creatures, animals, plants, fungi, bacteria, they all carry their own viruses. And the viruses that mammals carry are the ones that are most likely to be capable of infecting humans. We're mammals, after all.
Sure.
And so when you have wild animals in cages stacked upon one another in a busy market where hygiene is not as good as it should be, it's a tremendous opportunity for viruses to mix from one species to another and for humans to become exposed to those viruses.
You write a lot about the pangolin, which you describe as the most heavily trafficked animal that there is, but seeming to indicate that the pangolin at least could have some role to play in the spillover effect of SARS-CoV-2.
That's right. Pangolins are trafficked for food and also for their scales, which are thought on zero scientific basis to have some medicinal quality. There are four species that are native to Africa, four species native to Southern Asia, Southeast Asia, and they have been trafficked in huge numbers around the world, but particularly towards Southeast Asia into China. And pangolins have their own coronaviruses, and some of those pangolin coronaviruses have been shown to be very similar to this virus, the SARS-CoV-2 virus, in particular in certain sections of it. So scientists have worked on that, looked at carefully at different pangolin viruses, asked themselves whether perhaps this virus is the result of recombination between a bat coronavirus and a pangolin coronavirus inside either one of those two kinds of animals or possibly in a third kind of animal. And so pangolins have become involved in this whole conversation.
About a minute before our first break here, are you, I realize there's so much we still don't know, but are you, if not convinced, at least believing that we should seriously look at the pangolin then?
Oh, we should absolutely look at the pangolin. Pangolins should be sampled for viruses, for coronaviruses in particular. All sorts of wildlife across southern China and Southeast Asia need to be sampled. Bats, raccoon dogs, civets, porcupines. Some of these are wild animals that are raised in captivity for the food trade, and that is a situation that carries its own risks, and those animals in the food trade need to be sampled too. There's a lot of work that needs to be done looking for possible natural origins while not closing our minds entirely to the possibility of some other kind of an origin for this virus.
And that is David Quammen, our guest on Radio Times today. He's an award-winning science journalist, and he's got a brand new book we're talking about. It's called Breathless, The Scientific Race to Defeat a Deadly Virus. We are talking about SARS-CoV-2, the virus that created the pandemic that we are all still dealing with. Any questions or comments, you can email us at radiotimes@whyy.org, and you can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. Much more to talk about after this very short break. Do stay with us. We'll be right back.
Supporting WHYY, Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at PennMedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscow-Wayne, and if you're just joining us, I'm talking with science journalist David Quammen about what we learned about the origins of the COVID-19 pandemic, what we learned about the virus. And again, he's got a new book called Breathless, The Scientific Race to Defeat a Deadly Virus. And just to recap, here's a collection of news announcements beginning in the early days of the pandemic, before the U.S. and the world really knew what was ahead, up until President Biden's recent announcement about COVID-19 and that the pandemic was over.
Now to growing concerns about the deadly coronavirus officially hitting the U.S.
The warning from the CDC, the coronavirus is spreading so quickly around the globe, it may only be a matter of time before it begins rolling across the U.S. with the potential to become a pandemic.
The breaking news, stay at home. That is the order tonight from four state governors as the coronavirus pandemic spreads.
The U.S. coronavirus death toll has now topped 400,000. Pharmaceutical giant Pfizer just announced moments ago that its coronavirus vaccine is 95% effective and that they will apply for FDA emergency use approval within days.
Moderna announcing its vaccine is nearly 95% effective.
This country has now reached more than 1 million COVID deaths.
Even though vaccines don't protect overly well, as it were, against infection, they protect quite well against severe disease leading to hospitalization and death.
This morning, authorities across the country are under growing pressure to lift COVID-related restrictions.
At a certain point, you just have to start living like things are normal.
We still have a problem with COVID. We're still doing a lot of work on it, but the pandemic is over.
The pandemic is over, and that, of course, is President Biden speaking rather recently about the state of the pandemic. And David, is so, I mean, in certain ways, to encapsulate almost 2.5 years, or almost 3 years, I should say, of pandemic news down to 1 minute. On the one hand, it feels frightening. On the other hand, it's amazing, you know, what was accomplished in 3 years in terms of coming up with a vaccine, for instance.
Well, it is amazing. We were slow out of the blocks. And some mistakes were made and some problems were encountered. We didn't have diagnostic testing in the U.S. As quickly as we should have back in January, February, and March of 2020. But then we had this effort to develop vaccines as well as antivirals, and it was very, very successful. I interviewed at length 95 experts by Zoom in the course of researching this book, and one of those was Tony Fauci. Mm-hmm. I asked Tony Fauci, what was the most important decision you made in 2020? And he told me, well, scientific decision or political. And he mentioned a political decision. But the scientific decision was to, as soon as the genome of this virus could be gotten, he made sure it was in the hands of his researchers at the Vaccine Research Center, which is part of his institute within the National Institutes of Health. And he told them, I will get you the support. I will get you the money. When we get you the genome, just be ready to go and create a vaccine. And Barney Graham was the leader of that effort at the Vaccine Research Center. He started his team on it on the evening of January 10th when they had the genome. And within, I think it was something like less than 60 days, the first shot of the prototype, what became known as the Moderna vaccine, went into a volunteer human arm. And then, as the news clips showed, by autumn of that year, we had, vaccines that were highly effective, 95% effective, and especially effective in preventing people from being hospitalized and having to have intensive care.
And it's so hard.
So that was a great success.
Absolutely.
That was a speedy effort that we've never seen before.
And help us understand why the, and this is where you'll see my science ignorance fully on display, but the difference between RNA and DNA and why that's significant.
Well, DNA is the famous double helix molecule. It is a genetic information molecule that has high stability. The double helix form gives it stability. RNA is generally a single-stranded information genetic molecule. It's not as stable as DNA, but it also forms the genome of certain creatures, including coronaviruses. Their genome is RNA. It is in when the virus attacks a cell, its genome is run through the machinery, the metabolic machinery of the cell, and creates new viruses. The mRNA vaccines, messenger RNA vaccines, work by inserting not a killed virus or an attenuated virus into people's arms, but this molecule, a molecule of messenger RNA, which is just a fragment of the virus, and it provokes the immune system to react to that particular fragment of the virus, in this case, the spike protein, which is the protein that the virus uses to attach to cells. Mm. So inserting those instructions into the human body allows our cells to use that information molecule to create the proteins that we want our immune system to react to defend against. It's an extraordinarily ingenious form of vaccine, and it allows the technique, the platform, to be adapted to different kinds of viruses much more quickly than other vaccines of other sorts can be developed.
Yeah, I mean, it's truly incredible. It is called COVID-19 because it was first identified in 2019. Mm-hmm. Do we know when and where, David?
Well, it was first identified in the city of Wuhan as people started showing up at hospitals in Wuhan, yes. So the first 41 patients in particular were focused on people who had gone to hospitals in the city of Wuhan, and they had this peculiar pneumonia, an atypical pneumonia. Samples were taken from them, and scientists found evidence of a coronavirus. And then eventually they assembled the genome of that coronavirus, and the first genome, as I mentioned, was published online in China time, early morning, January 11th of 2020. Edinburgh time, where the website was, where it was published, was late at night on January 10th into January 11th.
And every moment and every day obviously counted. And you write about the numbers of scientists who are working sometimes together, sometimes independently, to help us understand this SARS-CoV-2 or even, you know, the SARS virus as well, and their ability to come together, sometimes to disagree with each other, but to sort of move us along this track is really quite extraordinary.
Well, yes, in a sense, the book is about the scientific process as well as about this particular virus. It's about the fact that science is a collaborative enterprise, that it uses empirical data, physical proof to move toward a more accurate and more confident understanding of the material world, but it's always provisional. It's always subject to revision. It's always subject to self-correction. And so I try to portray that. I write about the scientists who have studied this virus, molecular evolutionary virologists and molecular phylogeneticists, some very smart men and women around the planet, from China to Australia to Edinburgh to the U.S. and lots of other countries, connected to a great degree with one another, sharing ideas, sharing information, trying to understand better what this virus was, how it works, where it came from, where it's going, and how we can cope with it. And so it's a book full of detective stories.
It sure is, an amazing detective stories. Here's a question from Tim. He wants to know, where does the COV or corona term, where does that come from?
It comes from the fact that seen under an electron microscope, this virus, a single particle of this virus, looks like a sphere, it looks like a round ham with a bunch of cloves sticking out from it, the way you stick cloves into a ham when you roast it. Those cloves, those spikes, are, as I said, the protein that the virus uses to latch on to cells, but viewed in profile, it looks like a sun with a corona around it, the corona of these spikes, and that's where the family of viruses gets its name.
Now, there was, there have been obviously outbreaks through probably much of human history, but let's go back 20 years to the original, I guess, SARS outbreak. How is that connected to the outbreak that we had this time?
Well, that was a virus that emerged suddenly in southern China, first in mainland China around the city of Shenzhen, and then it got into the city of Hong Kong, and it emerged from a single hotel in the city of Hong Kong in people who had been staying at that hotel. They got on airplanes to go home from their vacations. They flew to Toronto, they flew to Beijing, they flew to Singapore, they flew to other places and carried this virus with them. So suddenly there was this outbreak in a number of cities of this very dangerous respiratory virus. It was affecting healthcare workers who were intubating people who were having respiratory crises. They didn't know what they were dealing with. They didn't know what the virus was. They didn't know how dangerous it was. It turned out it was a coronavirus causing the syndrome that came to be known as SARS, sudden acute respiratory syndrome. Now we think of it as SARS-1.
Yeah.
This was began in 2002, then 2003. But it was stopped after infecting about 8,000 people and killing about 800. And it could be stopped because we were fortunate that it was breaking out in cities that had strong healthcare systems. And there was something fortunate about it. It was not transmissible from people who were asymptomatic. You didn't transmit the virus until you started showing symptoms. And that made it stoppable. And that's the big difference between that virus and this virus. That's what made this virus so very, very dangerous, transmissible, and capable of pandemic. The fact that it does transmit from people before they feel sick, before they show symptoms.
And do we know why? I mean, do we understand the biology there, why that is the case with SARS-CoV-2?
We don't know it clearly enough, no. That's one of the things that scientists are still working on. It transmits because it becomes abundant in the upper respiratory tract of people. But, excuse me, and there I am still coughing a little bit.
Yeah, yeah.
But just why it becomes abundant in the upper respiratory tract and yet is not yet causing symptoms, I haven't seen an answer to that. It's one of the questions that the people who study the biology of this virus in the human body are working on.
You write about the Diamond Princess, and I think we all remember this cruise ship that had an outbreak of COVID early on in the pandemic. What did we learn about this virus from what happened on that cruise ship?
Right. This was a cruise ship launched from, I believe it was Yokohama in Japan, sailed along the coasts of Taiwan, Vietnam, on this cruise down to Hong Kong, and circled around back. And people started getting very sick on this voyage, possibly because of one man from Hong Kong who had boarded the ship already starting to feel ill and seems to have been patient zero for that particular cruise. And then it passed from person to person to person to person. And there is a scientist that I talked to based in Hong Kong, Professor K.Y. Yuen. He and his team studied people as they were taken off this boat, finally after the boat had been docked and quarantined, and people were being allowed to leave the boat in order to be isolated in their own countries. They were people from around the world. He studied those people who were coming off the boat and found a couple of things. Found that the virus was indeed transmissible from one human to another, and that it was capable of silent transmission. Transmission from asymptomatic cases. So KYUN and his team noted that very early on in January into February of 2020, and that was one of the very important alarm bells, as I describe in the book, for just how dangerous this virus was and why it was so dangerous.
And do we know why in certain, we've all heard anecdotally of certain families where, let's say, one member of the family got COVID, the other member of the family did not get COVID. They were all vaccinated. You know, one got COVID and one didn't. Do we know why people did not get COVID?
No, we don't. It's another of the mysteries. Mm-hmm. For instance, you know, I've been home for 2.5 weeks, testing positive, living in the same house, although keeping my distance from my wife, and knock wood, she has not, as far as we know, become infected, tested positive.
Yeah.
That experience is similar to the experience that I think probably millions of other people have had. It's not clear why some people are susceptible to this, why some people in certain situations of exposure to a positive person do not become positive themselves. We just don't know. Being vaccinated and boosted certainly helps, but we don't know that that's the whole story.
Yeah. Jennifer asks,
Tony Fauci told me,
yeah, go ahead.
Tony Fauci told me this is a very, This is a very nefarious and insidious virus during our conversation. It is indeed. It's enterprising, mysterious, and very, very adaptable.
Jennifer asked, as a reference point for a layperson, is the current strain of coronavirus more dangerous or more contagious than the seasonal flu? And we are entering the flu season. Oh, dear. Sorry, yeah. you're not.
It's a little hard to compare apples and oranges. This virus is still more dangerous than the average seasonal flu in terms of its case fatality rate. But if a person is well vaccinated against it, that case fatality rate goes way, way down. More transmissible than the seasonal flu. Again, we won't know about the next seasonal flu until it's upon us, and it will be upon us soon. The scientists and public health people are warning that we could have a bad seasonal flu season this year. Australia, which has already had its southern winter, had a bad flu season. We need to take influenza very, very seriously, but whether the new flu is going to be more lethal or less lethal than COVID, more transmissible or less transmissible, we really don't know, and we'll have to see. Both of those scenarios are possible.
About a minute before our second break here, just a quick follow-up question. I mean, we do know that this virus mutates and changes. Is that because there are enough hosts that it can and essentially latch onto, that if we were all, let's say, vaccinated, it would stop the virus?
Well, it would slow it down. All viruses mutate. That's a truism. All viruses mutate. Some mutate more frequently than others. This is the kind of virus that mutates fairly frequently. And also, as I said, it has the capacity to recombine sections of its genome. And both of those things create the raw material for Darwinian natural selection, evolution by natural selection. And that means the virus is capable of adapting quickly. In terms of, what was the other part of your question?
Well, you know what?
The second part.
That's okay. I'll tell you what, we're up in a break here. So let's take that break and then we'll get back to our conversation. And we are talking with award-winning science journalist David Quammen. He's written a number of books. He's got a new one that we are talking about. It's called Breathless, The Scientific Race to Defeat a Deadly Virus, talking about SARS-CoV-2. His other books include Spillover, Animal Infections and the Next Human Pandemic, written about a decade ago, and The Song of the Dodo. And again, you can join our conversation. Email us at radiotimes@whyy.org. And you can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. Do stay with us. We'll be right back.
Supporting WHYY, Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at pennmedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscow-Wayne. What have we learned about COVID-19? Nearly 3 years since the start of the pandemic. I'm talking with science journalist David Quammen about his new book. It's about how scientists figured out this virus, the vaccines and therapies that came from their work, what's ahead as both COVID-19 evolves and new animal viruses emerge. David, I do want to swing back. Just we were talking about these competing theories, whether this virus came from animal spillover or whether there was some kind of a lab leak. And you spend a fair amount of time on this book looking at both those particular theories, but essentially go with the animal spillover over the lab leak. Why?
Well, one of the reasons is that we have no evidence that this virus was ever in a lab. The scientists who study coronaviruses, including Professor Zhengli Shi at the Wuhan Institute of Virology, make it their career and get their career advancement from publishing what they find, from discovering dangerous new coronaviruses in wild animals, analyzing those viruses or their genomes in the lab, and frequently they have only their genome, and then publishing scientific papers. And Zhengli Shi's lab published a paper that showed that they had found the genome of a virus in a horseshoe bat that was 96.2 similar to this coronavirus 2. That's one of the closest, not the closest, but one of the closest matches we've seen. But neither Zheng Lixi nor anyone else ever published a discovery of a virus 99% similar to this. There is no evidence that this virus ever existed, either as a live virus or as a sample, a genome extracted from a sample, in any lab. So to create scenarios whereby this might have happened or that might have happened is to tell us that, yes, there's a non-zero possibility that a virus might have leaked from a lab that became this virus, but there is no positive evidence that this virus ever existed in a lab. And so we can't, I suppose, close our minds to that possibility, but the preponderance of positive evidence points to all the viruses similar to this that exist in wild animals and that have abundant opportunities for spilling into humans. So a leak from a wild animal into a human seems to me far, far, far more likely than a leak from a laboratory into a human.
You interviewed a lot of scientists, including a number of them, in China, but the Chinese government has not been completely forthcoming when it comes to information that has been criticized for just not essentially opening the book so that we can take a look. Is that part of the problem?
Yes, I think it is part of the problem. The Chinese officialdom is notorious for being reluctant to share information, being closed to inspection from outside. That's not to say Chinese scientists. I'm making a distinction between Chinese officialdom and Chinese scientists. There are some wonderful, wonderful, hardworking, collaborating virologists and other scientists in China who've been working on this virus, and some of them collaborating with Western partners like Professor Eddie Holmes in Sydney, Australia. But Chinese officialdom has been reluctant to share information with the rest of the world. And some people say, well, they're covering up a lab leak. I think it's perhaps more likely that what they are concerned about in terms of controlling information is perhaps not a lab leak, but a market leak. There were wild animals being sold as food in the Wanan seafood wholesale market, and that was against the law. Someone was looking the other way. There were certifications and permissions and licenses that were required that did not exist for the handling of these wild animals. And I think there is a strong possibility that the fact of wild animals having been sold in that market and exposing people to the viruses that wild animals carry may have been, as soon as this pandemic began, a fact of great embarrassment to Chinese officialdom. And that's one of the reasons, perhaps, that they have not wanted further scrutiny of that market or the things that was going on there.
Let me read a couple of more comments from our listeners. Erica wonders, she says, my mother is not planning to get her next booster. She says she knows a lot of people that have been double boosted and still gotten really sick, and that lots of people that haven't been vaccinated never got sick. She's implying that she thinks that the vaccine is making people sick, and Erica wants to know, can you address this?
Well, it's difficult to talk people out of that if they have consumed misinformation, they have consumed misleading pseudo statistics. I think that I sympathize with her in terms of trying to gently open her mother's mind to this. It's a terrible problem that we have, that people have been alienated from the notion of vaccines and from trust in science generally. Too many people, because of misinformation online, particularly in social media, that have given people these false suspicions and concerns about a technology that is saving lives and sparing people misery and risk all over the world. I don't know how you break through that.
No, I don't either. But I do think that when there is uncertainty and there is confusion and there is fear, it's just a perfect environment for conspiracy theories.
It is. And I think people need to be more aware of not just the information that they have found on the internet, but the sources of the information. They need to be skeptical and perspicacious in terms of looking at the source of this claim or this supposed study or that study. They need to understand better how the scientific process works, how professional scientists exist in a self-correcting, peer-reviewed universe of collaborating minds. And it's very different from someone just posting a rumor, a claim, or an accusation on the internet.
Philip says, you know, scientists compete with each other. There are some very credible ones who do believe it came from a lab. And then Philip goes on to say, we need to seriously question the orthodoxy of trusting where this comes from. And it sounds like, David, what you're saying is we need to be open to any and all theories, but we also need to be able to, I guess, what, use a scientific method if the theory doesn't pan out.
Yes, and I would respectfully correct Philip on that just a little bit. I would say there are some very respectable scientists who argue that the virus might have come from a lab, could have come from a lab, that we cannot rule out the possibility yet that it came from a lab. And I've talked with some of those scientists. Those are some of the people I interviewed. I listened to them with great respect. And people like David Relman of Stanford and Jesse Bloom of the Fred Hutchinson Cancer Research Institute in Seattle and Mark Lipsitch at Harvard and others. And what they were saying was not, here is proof that this virus came from a lab. There is no such proof. But they have been saying, we need to continue to keep our minds open to that possibility until we finally answer the question of where this virus came from. And they have a good point there.
Fair enough. John asks, why are we still calling it COVID-19 as opposed to any other year? I mean, 2019 was when it was identified. Will that be, David, what we know this virus will be called into the future?
It probably will be called, the disease will be called COVID-19 into the future, and the virus will be called SARS-CoV-2, SARS coronavirus 2, into the future. And that's just a matter of professional taxonomy within the scientific community, the classification and naming of organisms. They're very, very well-defined international rules as to how names are given to biological entities. So we're probably stuck with those terms.
And he actually, I misrepresented what he said. His real question is, why did this happen in 2019, which is maybe even a harder question.
Well, why did it happen in 2019?
Yeah.
It happened because the world is full of viruses, and many of them are time bombs that are ticking, and we can't predict when they will go off. So humans are coming into contact with wild animals daily in massive numbers all over the world, and that's by capturing wildlife for food. That's by going into tropical forests and building timber camps and mining camps, where the workers have no protein unless they eat wildlife, eat bushmeat from the surrounding forest. All of these activities that involve humans coming in contact with highly diverse ecosystems and the animals that live in those ecosystems represent increased possibilities every day for a new virus to spill from a non-human animal into a human. And it's happened repeatedly. My book, Spillover, recounts case after case over the last 60 to 80 years of this happening, yielding all kinds of viral diseases from Ebola to SARS-1 to Nipah virus to monkeypox. And this one just happened to occur in the late months of 2019.
You write about dogs and cats getting this virus. A tiger at the Bronx Zoo got this virus. Minks got this virus. What does that tell us?
It tells us that this virus, from the beginning, was very broadly adapted for the capacity to infect mammals, not just humans. There was a Pekingese, as I recall, a Pekingese dog in Hong Kong in the first month or so of the pandemic that tested positive for the coronavirus. As you mentioned, tigers in zoos, snow leopards in zoos, gorillas in the San Diego Zoo tested positive for it. American mountain lion at a zoo in South Africa tested positive for it. Mink all over Europe, both farmed mink and mink that have escaped from farms and gone feral on the landscapes of Denmark and the Netherlands have tested positive for it. White-tailed deer in the U.S., have tested positive for it in huge numbers. It has passed from humans into these other animals, and now it will probably be in those other animals forever. So even if we were to clear the virus from the human population, which is, I think, impossible to do, even if we could accomplish that, there's great opportunity for humans to become reinfected, not just from a bat in southern China, but from a white-tailed deer in Iowa, because they're carrying the virus too.
Wow.
It's a broadly adapted, enterprising, ingenious, nefarious, insidious, as Tony Fauci said, virus.
Well, and speaking of the human population, I'm not sure what percentage of the world is actually vaccinated, but you make the point and interview a number of scientists, including a Dr. Hotez, people have probably seen him on television, saying we need to have a vaccine that doesn't require refrigeration, for instance, to be able to vaccinate the rest of the world. How do we do that?
That's right. Well, scientists, including Peter Hotez, have been working on that, and he has come up with his team with a prototype vaccine, the last I heard. It's very important, Marty. It's the issue of vaccine equity around the world. There are people in this country who have the opportunity to get the vaccine, and they don't want to get it because they've been led to believe it won't work or it's dangerous to them or Bill Gates is going to put a chip in them or something. And that's vaccine denial, vaccine rejection. But equally problematic in other parts of the world is vaccine unavailability. There is only a very small percentage of the population of the continent of Africa who have been vaccinated against this virus, and largely that's because of vaccine inevitability. We have to fix that, and one of the ways, as Peter Hotez and others have said, to fix that is by creating vaccines that do not require deep freezing or refrigeration, that do not necessarily require needles, a heat-stable non-injectable vaccine, something that can be taken as a patch on the arm or as a pill that you swallow, something that can be put on the back of a motorbike of a paramedic person who is going to motor down some dirt trails in the center of the Democratic Republic of the Congo to get to remote villages and get those people vaccinated. That's a very, very severe need in terms of getting everybody vaccinated. And as you asked me earlier before the break, what's the implication of so many people being unvaccinated and this virus existing in so many people? We know that it has infected more than 600 million people around the world, and that means it has uncountable chances to mutate, to change, to recombine, and to evolve new variants. So as long as it exists in lots of people, this virus will be capable of evolving quickly and tossing off new variants that are a danger to everybody.
We're almost out of time here, but I just want to read the last couple of sentences from your book. You write, "One thing is nearly certain. I believe amid the swirl of uncertainties, COVID-19 won't be our last pandemic of the 21st century. It probably won't be our worst." And I hate to give you no time to respond to that, David Quammen, but just final thoughts, 30 seconds, if you don't mind.
Sure. Well, there are lots of other viruses out there, coronaviruses, influenza viruses, avian influenza virus that could infect humans and become transmissible. And it's possible that they would be as transmissible as this virus, but with a higher case fatality rate. Mm-hmm. And if that happened, on top of COVID-19, then God help us.
God help us. Well, David Quammen, thank you as always for joining us today on Radio Times and helping us understand the science, the biology of this wily virus.
Thank you, Marty. Always a pleasure to talk with you, and thanks for your interest.
Absolutely, and I hope you feel better as well. He's got COVID.
Thank you very much. Appreciate that.
And David Quammen's new book is called Breathless, The Scientific Race to Defeat a Deadly Virus. To replay this hour, many more hours of Radio Times, go to WHYY.org and look for Radio Times under programs. You can also download a podcast of the show wherever you get your podcasts. Charlie Kyer, the engineer for today's edition of Radio Times, the show produced by Debbie Builder and Paige Murray-Bessler. I'm Marty Moscoane. Thank you so much for joining us.